Okay, so just again to recap what the background for this. So again, Rav Melamed is considered one of the leading poskim in the religious Zionist world. Simply from a practical perspective, his work is very readable, and his books have become very popular. They're given out in Israeli high schools. So whether people agree with him or not, his perspective is important. And like I said, this was a tshuva, or a first draft of a tshuva that came out over the summer. And again, it's questioning whether the halacha that we know of Hilchos Kashrus, whether it should remain the same. So, you've read through a lot of it. I'm not going to read through each piece, but as it's necessary, we'll read through issues. But I want to summarize the central issues that are raised. So, in general, in Kashrus, let's just trace from the Torah down and how we get to our modern kitchens, right? This becomes an old rabbinic joke. Not a particularly good joke, but there is the point of it, right? But it's, you know, just a running joke that the Torah says three times, don't cook milk and meat, from which we derive that you need two kitchens, right? But if you think about it, right, what do we start with? We start with, what prohibitions do we have in Kashrus that we know of? Right, we have the prohibitions against milk and meat. Right? Again, the Torah says three times, don't cook a calf in its mother's milk, from which we derive on a biblical level that you can't cook, eat, or benefit from milk and meat which were cooked together. Right? That sounds redundant, but it's not. I mean, you can't cook milk and meat together. You can't eat on a biblical level milk and meat that was cooked together, but you can have milk and meat that are not cooked together, and you can't benefit from milk and meat that were cooked together. But again, if you had milk and meat which were mixed together, then you would be allowed to eat it on a biblical level, and you would be allowed to benefit from it on a biblical level. And then we have other isuri achila, other things which are forbidden to eat, such as all the non-kosher animals, right? Which in the Torah is called behemot tmeot, right? Whether that be pig, or that be fish without fins and scales, or that be birds that are not found on the list of kosher birds. And then we have kosher species which are not kosher to eat because of one of two reasons. Either they are nevela, which means they died without shechita, or they're trefa, which means that they have some physical imperfection that would have led to their death within 12 months. Right, so that is basically the categories of things that are not kosher, quote unquote. Right, there are other things, obviously, that are in that category generally. Primarily in Israel, though a few that will overflow into Chutz La'aretz as well, right? New grain, right? Chadash before Pesach, anything that's grown and hasn't yet had gone through the 16th of Nisan. Things during Shemitah are not exactly forbidden to eat. You can't do business with them, but if you would do improper business with them, or you would hold on to them, so that might create Nisr Achila when you plant fruits and vegetables. So some of it goes to the Kohen, Truma, so that a Yisrael can't eat, right? There are different prohibitions. But basically, when we talk about not kosher food, we mean the first categories. We mean milk and meat, we mean nevela, and we mean trefa. Now, in addition to the prohibition of eating those items, so we have a host of prohibitions that are predicated on one very simple assumption that the Gemara sets forth in Avodah Zarah, which is what we call tam, simply taste. Then in addition to the food itself being prohibited, we rule that the taste is forbidden, which means, there's a machlokas in the Gemara whether that's biblical or rabbinic, whether that's d'oraisa or d'rabbanan, but the principle of tam tells us that not only can you not eat milk and meat, but if you had a pot in which a cheeseburger was cooked, so now any food that was cooked in that same pot and has absorbed the taste of the cheeseburger is forbidden. Similarly, if you had milk in a pot and then you cooked meat in it so that the tastes mixed, the resulting food would be prohibited. The same thing true of nevela, the same thing true of trefa, etc. And from that, we derive the whole set of laws that we have, that you have to have separate pots and pans, and the like. In addition, there's a host of rabbinic prohibitions that are aimed at ensuring that you never mix milk and meat or you never end up eating not kosher. So some of the prohibitions have nothing to do with the biblical thing. So, for example, the prohibition against baking dairy bread or meat bread is a prohibition because you might eat it with the opposite object, which is not actually forbidden biblically because they weren't cooked together, but it's rabbinic. Or the prohibition against using the same tablecloth for meat and milk, which may or may not apply nowadays, because the Gemara is talking about tablecloths that you actually eat on the table rather than where you eat on a plate on the tablecloth. But the Gemara has such a prohibition. And then there are a host of other things that drive us crazy in our kitchens because of the assumption of taste. So, in general, taste is assumed to transfer only through heat, with an exception of what we call davar harif, which is right, any sharp food like onions, garlic, which the Gemara doesn't list. The Gemara's examples are actually chilsis, which is asafoetida, which is a particularly, if anyone cooks Indian food, then you'll know what it is, but it's that very, very sharp thing that makes Indian food very, very hot. That's asafoetida. It's much, much sharper than our onions. But if you use that, so then, even when it's cold, we rule that taste can be transferred. Okay. So, what becomes clear is that the laws of kashrus, to a large extent, are all built on this assumption of taste transference. And that's what kashrus is basically predicated on. In addition to all of those halachot, however, there's a second halacha, or a second set of halachot, which is, okay, what do you do if something has become treif? So what do? We call it koshering, right? Colloquially. We call it koshering. Now, what is koshering? What? Not tvila, right? Tvila doesn't help with koshering, right? There's two things, right? Well, where do we derive it all from? We derive it all from Midian, right? So number two. And that's where tefillah comes up as well. In Midian, so when the Jews win the war against Midian, so what they bring back to the camp are the spoils. In the spoils are, among other things, dishes, pots, pans, plates, cups, whatever they have. Moshe tells them that if they want to use the vessels that were used by non-Jews, they have to do two things. One is what Adina said, which is tefillah. But the purpose of tefillah is what? The purpose of tefillah is to add holiness to the object. Right? How do we know this? Right? If you go out and you buy a new pot or pan, which has never been used, you have to be tovel. Right? You have to be tovel. It has nothing to do with kashrus because it could be new. There could be no taste in it whatsoever. You need to bring it to a mikvah. Anything that was owned by a non-Jew, if you now own it, you need to bring it to the mikvah. If you own it. Okay? I'll say that one more time. Anything you buy from a non-Jew and now transfers into your possession, you need to bring to a mikvah. If it was originally built by a Jew, then he doesn't need to be tovelled, right? If meaning it was originally owned by a Jew, and it's always been owned by a Jew until it gets to you, you don't have to be tovel it. If, on the other hand, you don't own it, you also don't need to be tovel it, right? If you go to a non-Jew's house, and he gives you a glass, or she gives you a glass of cold water in a clean glass cup, which has never been toveled, you are allowed to drink from it, right? Because you only have an obligation to be tovel that which you now own. Ara is smiling. She knows the story I'm thinking of, right? When we were right before Sukkot, we were scholars in residence at Princeton. And we stayed by a visiting professor from Hebrew U who is at the Institute, which is a research institute in Princeton, in the city of Princeton, not in the university. And the Institute, when it brings in its researchers, it tries to make it so that they can focus entirely on research. They do everything so that your life is, right, has no, right, there's no problems in your life. Everything is taken care of, food, house, everything. I mean, so what they did was, because he keeps kosher, was they bought him a new set of dishes, but they didn't give it to him, right? They own it. When he goes back to Israel at the end of the year, the end of his sabbatical, it continues to be owned by the Institute. Therefore, he didn't have to be tovel it because it belongs to a non-Jew. It was a new dish which didn't have to be tovel. Therefore, the day he got off the plane, he could use the dishes right away without bringing them to the mikvah, right? So tefillah is only if you take something from a non-Jew and it now enters your ownership. There's a second halacha, which is we call koshering or hechsher kelim, where in addition to making it holy, we have to remove the problems. That's what we call Hechsher. That's what we call Hechsher Kelim, where the assumption is that that which a non-Jew owned, presumably used it for non-kosher food, because why not? He or she is not obligated to keep kosher, so presumably they did not. What do we need to do with their vessels? Right? How do you kosher? So we have two types of koshering, which are
boiling,
right? What we call hagala. Now, what do we use hagala for? Right, so as the pasuk says in number 2, kol asher yavo ba'esh taviru ba'esh, right? V'chol asher lo yavo ba'esh taviru ba'mayim, right? Anything which is cooked, which we cook using liquid, and therefore its contact with the non-kosher food was through the medium of liquid, such as a pot which you cook soup in, so then you need to boil it out. And anything which is used with fire, such as, right, the easiest one, the Gemara's example is a spit. Right, a spit is pretty straightforward, right? If you think like my big fat Greek wedding or just a shawarma place, right, where the metal stick goes through the meat and it goes through fire, right? That is taviru ba'esh. So then you need to do what's called libun, right? You need to burn it out. Okay. Now the Gemara on that in number 3 asks the question, why do you need to do that? Right, because now we have to put these two issues in conversation with each other. Why would you assume that a clean pot that you get from a non-Jew needs to be kosher if you assume there's still taste? Right? But there's another halacha, which is, how long does taste last in a pot? Right, if you have a pot and you cooked chicken soup in it, how long will we assume that that pot can now impart chicken soup taste into the next food in it, right? How long does that taste last?
24 hours.
Right. So what the Gemara calls ben yomo, right? Within which the way we paskin is 24 hours. There is a position that just means till the end of the day, right? Rashi thinks that means till the end of the day, meaning as long as it's overnight, it's fine. But the standard halacha is 24 hours, and after that, the taste is what we call nosein tam lifgam. Right, notain tam lifgam. Right, within 24 hours, the taste is notain tam lishvach. The taste is still good, and therefore, if you like the taste of chicken soup, so if you cook chicken soup in it at noon, and then at 3 o'clock you cook, you cook a vegetable soup. The assumption is that it will give a positive taste, like actual chicken taste. It'll be like adding chicken stock to your vegetable soup, and it will taste better because of the taste absorbed into the walls. After 24 hours, the assumption is any taste that is emitted would be spoiled, and therefore it's no longer prohibited, because when we say that ta'am, when we say that taste is prohibited, it's only prohibited when it is still positive, when it still tastes good. The Gemara then asks, okay, but if that's the case, then why is it that the Torah requires you to kosher vessels 24 hours after you get the vessels from the non-Jew? What's going to happen? All the absorbed taste will now, right, be bad, and therefore irrelevant halachically. So why should you ever have to kosher? So the Gemara answers, that's true, but its last line is, Gzeira kedera she'ina bat yoma, mishum kedera bat yoma. We're worried that you're going to use the pot within 24 hours, and therefore the entire institution of koshering is only because you might use the vessel that had non-kosher food within the first 24 hours. That's the entire institution of koshering, and that's it. Right, that's how the Gemara presents it, which we'll come back to whether that's in fact what the Gemara means, but that's the simple read of the Gemara. So with all of that background in mind, if we look back at number 1, Rav Melamed asked the question. He said, okay, that's very nice, but all of this hangs on the single assumption that there is in fact such a thing as taste that manages to go from your chicken soup into the walls of the pot, and then from the walls of the pot emit itself back into your vegetable soup and make it fleishik, back into your cream of mushroom soup and make it basar b'chalav and therefore not kosher, or you accidentally cook, I don't know how you got this, but you cook pig in your soup, in your pot, and now it emits itself into whatever the case may be, right? All hangs on the assumption that taste somehow magically goes into the walls, is retained in the walls, and then emitted back into the next dish that's cooked. And as he says in number 1, בחודשים האחרונים עסקנו בשאיבה בשאלה גדולה בסוגי הכשרת כלים שבישלו בהם מאכלים אסורים. We've dealt with this big question in yeshiva regarding koshering vessels that were used to cook forbidden foods, basar v'chalav, machalei treif, right? Not kosher foods or meat and milk. Hitbarer me'iver l'kol safek b'mechkarim madayim u'mitoch nisyonam shekol anishim shebachanu zot b'mitbacham ha'beiti. He said, we have proven, both through scientific studies and in the good old-fashioned experiment, he sent everybody home. He said, cook at home and try this out, right? He didn't mean cook treif. But halakhically, all you would have to do is cook chicken soup, and then 2 hours later, cook vegetable soup, and see, do you taste the chicken soup in your vegetable soup? And shockingly, what was the result of all of their scientific and non-scientific experiments? Did they or did they not taste chicken soup in their vegetable soup? No, nothing, right? We all know this is true. It never happens. Our vessels do not absorb, nor do they spit out taste. Klomar. Meaning, if you take a dish, and it's fully clean, and you cook vegetable soup in it just an hour later, lo yeba chalav shum tam basar, right? You do it with milk and meat, there will be no taste. Right, you cook treif and then you cook vegetables. Nothing will be tasted in the vegetables. So therefore, simply our conclusion should be that all of Hilchos Kashrus, kashering, separating milk and meat dishes, everything short of eating pig or eating a cheeseburger should be permitted, right? That is what should happen, right? If everything hangs on taste, and all of our halachot are predicated on the assumption that there is taste that transfers, and it turns out that that's not true, then kashrus should basically, as we know it, right, disappear, right? Or kashrus shouldn't disappear. All the things that make it difficult to keep kashrus should disappear, because it should be very, very hard to ever violate Hilchos Kashrus. So the question he wanted to deal with was, is that or is that not, is that or is that not the case? Okay. Now, in order to figure that out, he had to ask, and this is what we always do in halacha, right? If you think that you now have a new, right, a new reality, so now, what do you always do when you have a new reality, right? What we do in life in general, right? If you face a new situation, so what do? You try to, right? How do we face new situations, unless you're really, really creative, right? You usually try to find precedent, where you faced something similar at some point, right? That's normally what we try to do. So Rav Malamud said, okay, do I have any precedent for dealing with the question of what would you do with a vessel that does not absorb taste? So the answer is, we do in fact have such precedent. If you look at 5, so we have precedent in both directions. In general, when we talk about koshering, we limit that to certain types of vessels, namely ones that are made of metal. And metal can be koshered. It's pretty easy to kosher metal for a whole bunch of reasons, right? First of all, because we assume that the taste comes out, and also because it's pretty easy to kosher because you're not worried it's going to be destroyed, right? You take, right, one of the halachot of koshering is that it needs to be that you're not afraid that you're going to destroy the object, because if you're afraid, then what inevitably is going to happen? You're not going to kosher it, right? If you're afraid that by koshering you're going to break it, you're not going to kosher it, and therefore it will still be treif. But metal, we're not so worried, right? I mean, you know, you're not taking your fine china. We'll get to why fine china is a problem in just a second, right? But even if you could kosher fine china, you would not want to, let's say, right, take a blowtorch to your fine china, right? Even if that would work, you wouldn't want to do it because it'll destroy it, and therefore you would never do it, which is not true of the grates in your oven. The grates in your oven, right, they do it less here. But if you go to Israel, you'll probably remember, for if you were around Pesach time, you'll just see in the middle of the street, right, there'll be these massive koshering stations. They'll have huge buckets of boiling hot water, which they dip things into, and they'll have a bunch of guys with, like, you know, 15-year-olds with blowtorches just, right, torching pieces of ovens, pieces of stoves, and the like.
Right?
What?
They do that.
They go to here. Great. Also, 15-year-olds. Okay. I assume there must be more safety codes in any country, but Israel. I just assume. Now, the exception is what the Gemara says in number 5. Atari yid al kli cheresh eino yotzei midei dafyo le'olam. That clay, or china, is assumed to never give up its taste, and therefore once clay has become treif, it is treif forever and can never be used. Whether that's actually true is a machloket. Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks that at least in the case of fine china, where there's a significant loss involved, so there is a way of koshering it. You leave it for a year, not used, and then after you leave it for a year, so then you spend 72 hours soaking it in water, every 24 hours changing the water. Whether that's true or not is a machloket, but usually clay vessels do not kosher. But what about glass? Right, glass is a bit tricky. So glass can go in one of two directions. The Shulchan Aruch, in number 6, rules that glass is unique, and kli's chuchit afilu machnisin lekiyum v'afilu mishtamesh b'hem b'chamin, even if you keep them permanently, and even if you use them for hot food, ein tzrichin shum hechsher she'inam bolim. You do not ever need to kasher glass, u'bishtifa ba'al masag ilu, all you need to do is rinse it. And Svardim to this day rule that glass has the unique property of neither absorbing nor emitting taste. And therefore, Svardim rule that if you have a glass vessel and you use it to cook, if you cook it with milk, right, you could still use it for meat, right? You don't need pariv, glass vessels. All you need to do is clean them. Because glass is incapable of absorbing and incapable of emitting taste. And therefore, they are the perpetually kosher objects. The Rama, right, the Ashkenazim, that's less clear. The Rama, this is the second half of 6, says, V'yesh machmirim v'omrim d'kleis chuchet afilu agol l'mahani l'hu. Some people think that glass is like clay, and therefore can never be koshered. V'chein ha-minag b'ashkenaz v'midonot l'ilu. And that is the custom in Ashkenaz. And therefore, Ashkenazim do not use glass for both milk and meat. Now, what the Rama actually means is not clear, right, because the Achronim divide whether the Rama actually means that. Like, do Ashkenazim always think that you can't kosher glass? Or this halacha is found in the middle of Hilchos Pesach. Is it only by Pesach where we're stringent? But the status of glass is a discussion for another time. The point is that both the Rama and the Shulchan Aruch agree that if glass wouldn't absorb, right, they're arguing about whether or not glass absorbs. But if glass wouldn't absorb, so then we have precedent to say that what do you do when you have a vessel which doesn't absorb taste? You can use it for milk and meat. There's no problem, right? You don't need to separate. And that's what Sfardim do with glass. And Ashkenazim, if they disagree, they only disagree because they think glass does absorb. But we have precedent in Halacha for a vessel which in fact does not absorb and therefore does not emit taste, which is basically the status that he's claiming is true of everything that we own. Right, all of our stainless steel pots, right? I assume most of the things you have at home are not, you know, handmade clay pots from some artisan in Svat, right? They are, right, stainless steel pots that you bought for $20 at wherever you bought them, at Sears, right? And, you know, stainless steel doesn't absorb, or they're Teflon, right? Whatever they are, right? So what do we do, right? Once you put all that information together, which is a lot of information, but once you put it together, right, which basically comes down to 2 points, which is Hilchot Kashrut hang on the notion of taste, and our pots don't absorb taste, and there is precedent for pots which don't absorb taste, which do not need kashering, and can be used for milk and meat consecutively, obviously not simultaneously, but for a different problem. So what do? Do we take all of Hilchot Kashrut and throw it out, right, go home and now have one kitchen, right, one sink, right, one everything, right, the same spoons and forks and knives and pots and pans and cups and, you know, some of those you can have the same, some of those you can't, but just whatever separation you have in your house, and I'm sure some of you only have two sinks, or even have one sink. Some of you have one oven, some of you have two ovens, some of you have three ovens, some of you have six ovens, whatever, right? People do all type of crazy things. And what would happen is that we don't need to do any of that, right? So that was the question that he wanted to deal with. But as he notes, that question is not just a question about kashrus, right? That is a question that poskim deal with all the time, because this is by far, right, not the only case where poskim suddenly realized that the halacha is based on a fact, or was thought of to be a fact, that is simply untrue. So the locus classicus for this is the Gemara says in Shabbos that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos, because lice are assumed to spontaneously generate, and therefore the prohibition of killing them doesn't apply. And already for several hundred years, the poskim have dealt with the question of, okay, well, what do we do nowadays? Right? Lice do not spontaneously generate. Right? Anyone who's ever had lice knows that they do not spontaneously generate. They come from eggs. It takes a very long time to get those eggs out. Right? A very, very, very long time to get those eggs out. They do not come from nowhere. They come from eggs. Right? They procreate like any other creature, right? And it's not asexual reproduction, right? It is sexual reproduction. They lay eggs, and that's where they come from. So what is the halacha? Are you allowed to kill lice on Shabbos or not, right? And the poskim have, right, had radically different positions, right? So as a theoretical, before we look at what he does, right, let's take that case for example. Right? If the question was posed to you, right, and it said, okay, the Gemara says you're allowed to kill lice because they don't procreate, and therefore they're not fully alive, or however you want to understand that. Our science tells us that it's not true. Right? It's not true. They do procreate. So what would you say? Is it permitted to kill lice on Shabbos or not permitted to kill lice on Shabbos?
Not permitted.
Why? Right, so one possibility would be to say, look, the halacha is based on a fact. The fact turns out to be wrong. The principle of halacha is the same. I mean, the principle is you can kill that which doesn't procreate. Chazal thought that lice didn't procreate. It turns out they were wrong. Therefore, we take the principle but not the facts, and we update the halacha. We take the principle, we update it to reflect the reality. Right? That would be one possibility. Right? Now, what else could you say? Now, let's say you wanted to defend Chazal. You wanted to say we're going to update halacha. Now, that's the most, let's say, radical position in one direction, which is to say Chazal are allowed to make mistakes in science, and if they do, we change the halacha, period, end of story. Okay? That's possibility one. Possibility two is, how would you say that we update the halacha without impugning Chazal scientific knowledge, if that's what you want to do? I tend to agree with what you just said, but I think I'm in the minority of voices. What?
Yeah, no, for the sake of it, yeah.
Right? How could you say, right, you've probably heard this at some point, right? What people call nishtane hateva, say nature changed, right? Sometimes you'll hear people will say that nature is different, that it used to be that they spontaneously generated, and now they don't. Now, without getting to the question of whether you buy that scientific assumption, right, which I don't, but sometimes I do, but not here. I mean, sometimes it is in fact true that science has changed, not because, like, the world has magically changed, because certain things change, right? Whatever, right? Diseases, right, change. They develop. You develop bacteria-resistant strains of whatever, right? What wasn't pikuach nefesh 50 years ago might be pikuach nefesh now, and vice versa, right? That's true. There are things that change in reality.
The size of lice.
Right?
The
The thank you. I'm not getting to that, right? Whatever, and you know, sociology changes, psychology changes, things like that do change. There are such things as change, right? If you talk about halachot that are predicated on height, right? Height has changed significantly, right? I was a giant in the you know 1700s, right? As we know from the size of houses, right? Doorways were about my height, right? Because you know tall people were about five, whatever, low five feet because nutrition changed. There are things that change. That's true. There are other things that don't. But some people will say, no, nishtanu ateva. Now, nishtanu ateva is a way of saying, we'll update the halacha without impugning Chazal's scientific knowledge by saying they were right for their time, but now our lice are procreating lice, and therefore we change the halacha. Or you could say, we don't change the halacha. Now, why would you say you don't change the halacha? Now, I don't want anyone to assume that by asking your opinion, I'm asking you to stake your claim behind this position. So, theoretically, why could you say you won't change the halacha? Right, so one would be tradition, right? Would be to say, well, theoretically we could change the halacha, but we won't because tradition. Now that will usually work to allow maintaining a stringency rather than introducing a leniency, but not necessarily, right? Other possibilities. Why would you keep halacha the same? Yeah. Correct, right? You could say, what some people say, is Chazal said that lice, you could kill lice. Now, they said the reason was because lice didn't procreate. Now, either you can say, well, that's not the only reason, right? And there are other reasons why it's true, and therefore the halacha remains true. Or some people will say, in the time of Mashiach, we'll be able to change halacha, but at this point in history, we can't change what Chazal said. And therefore, the halacha just remains frozen in time as if it were still true. Right? There are different variations on that theme, right? But there are all types of variations that go in that direction. That, or, what of the positions I think it's still true, the one that I like the best is what Rosh Hashanah Zalman says, is maybe Chazal never meant they don't procreate. They meant that the only thing that's significant halachically is what you can see with the naked eye, and we can't see that lice procreate, and therefore it's as if they don't procreate. Right? That Chazal never actually, it wasn't actually based on a scientific fact, it was based on perception, and the rule was really that which you perceive as procreating can't be killed on Shabbos, or some version of that. And the last possibility is to say, who says reality changed? You said the scientists say that, just deny it, right? That's also a possibility, right? Not necessarily, not one I would endorse, but there are serious poskim who said that as well, who said, it's very simple, right? If we have Chazal telling us that lice don't procreate, and you have the scientists telling you that they do, the scientist must be wrong. You can see the eggs, big deal. Right? Don't trust your eyes either. Right? Chazal know more than what you see, than what science says. Right? That's a theoretical possibility, which in fact is taken by some people. Again, not one I would endorse, but one that exists. So now you come to the... Yeah?
Can you also just say that when you have a certain like scientific reality that Chazal like believed in, and then it's so much a part of the system, that unraveling the system just becomes so difficult?
Right, I mean that's a form of the tradition argument, right? Like I said, there's 10 different variations on it, which is either it's frozen in time. I mean, the Dor Revi'i, Moshe Glasner, right? He just says Moshe Glasner, one of those, says that basically it's just because we went into Galus, and therefore if halacha was flexible when we're in Galus, it would lead to disaster. We froze halacha by writing down the Gemara, and it's frozen in time until such time that Mashiach comes. And when Mashiach comes, we'll take the Gemara and the Mishnah, we'll throw them in the garbage, right? The Torah will go back to being oral, and then everything will be up for grabs again. Right? That's like his radical thesis, is that written Torah is binding, oral Torah is changeable. When you're in Galus, if everything is oral, the Torah will be lost. So we had to freeze halacha in time with the act of stimat ha-Talmud, right, with the act of sealing the Talmud, of writing it down. When Mashiach comes, we will just get rid of it. And Ravina and Ravashi and Rava and Abaye and all those people will be no more than other names that we quote in a machloket. Important people, but they will not be binding. Hillel, Shammai, all those people, forget everything you ever learned. Right? We're going to have to rewrite halacha when Mashiach comes. It's basically his assumption, right? Which is a radical one. What Rav Melamed will do here is a little bit less extreme than that, right? Okay. So, what I like about Rav Melamed, I don't always agree with him, but there are certain things I very much like about his tshuvot and his writing, is that one of them is that he's methodologically conscious. He tells you what he's doing and why he's doing it. Right? So if you look at 7, he raises this. Right? He notes that this is a broader issue. And he says, right, I'll just say it outside, right? You've read it inside and it's, right? He says that some people are going to tell you, right, at the two extremes. Some people will say that now that we know that there is no taste, that you can't change the halacha for one of two reasons. Either we deny science, right? Which he admits. Some people take that position, that we trust Chazal for our science. Not just for halacha, but for science. And therefore, we just deny what our eyes see. Some people will say that. Alternatively, he says, some people will say what Adina said. It's not that we don't think the new science is right. It's God knows what will happen if we start unraveling all of Hilchos Kashrus. Right, you'll take, we don't have it here, but you'll take, right, all those halacha books, right? You know, how to have a kosher kitchen, the halachos of kashrus, all those. You have to rewrite the whole thing. Right? All the things we've grown up with are going to be thrown out. Right? It'll be chaos. It'll be absolute chaos. We just can't do it. Even if in theory we could do it, we can't do it. That's not how halacha works. Right? Halacha intuitively hates revolution. Right? This is what, right, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein always likes saying. Halacha likes evolution, not revolution. Right? And whenever we're faced with halachic revolution, we just reject it. Right? Usually. Right? Because revolution is dangerous. Right? As is true in the political sphere. Revolutions, even good revolutions, were bloody. Right? We don't like revolutions if we can avoid it. Right? Sort of the difference between the way America became free of England and the way Canada did. Right? You know, right? You may think it was a good thing, but America's was much bloodier than Canada's, which sort of just happened at some point, right? And some, I don't even know when, what, in the 50s or something? I don't know, sometime in the 20th century, just sort of, in some weird way, became free of England, in some ways didn't, right? And there was no bloodshed, right? In America, there was. You may think America's a great thing, but, right, revolution is dangerous. At the other extreme, what could you do? You could take the extreme, right, to take our lice example, and just say, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Adina.
Also Adina. So Adina said, right, we could just say, no, halacha was based on a scientific reality. The principle is, tam, taste is important. If there is no taste, we have precedent for this. It's called glass, right? If there's no taste, then there's no hilchos kashrus, right? And throw the whole thing out. The alternative is what he actually takes, which is, to split it and say, there are some halachot. Well, we assumed that everything was dependent on taste. Maybe that's only partially true. And therefore, some halachot will change and some halachot will not change. And that's the position he takes. So, I'm going to summarize his position outside, but you can, you know, you have it here now, the whole article plus the translation. So let's construct his argument. Again, I want just to keep in mind not just the local arguments he's making, but the, as you see, right, he's consciously setting a precedent for how we deal with halachic change, right, in light of scientific and scientific information. So he says as follows. He says, okay, let's divide it. Let's think about it. When we're talking about Hilchos Kashrus, we actually mean two things. One is the question of kashering kalim, which is what we call a lechatchila question, an ab initio question, right? Which is, going forward, what is the best way to go? And the second set of questions are bidyevit questions, meaning, if I already cooked in a pot, what do I do? So if Malama takes the position that all quote-unquote bidyevit questions, post-facto questions, are all exactly what they look like, taste questions, right? So anytime I cook milk in a pot, and then an hour later I cook meat in the pot, the question halacha is, does it or does it not taste like milk and meat? If it tastes like milk and meat, it is not kosher. If it doesn't taste like milk and meat, it is kosher. Right? And how do you know, right? So if you go through Hilchot Kashrut, if you ever learn Hilchot Kashrut, you'll see that if a little bit of milk falls into a pot, so then how do we know whether you're allowed to have your cholent? It depends, right? If it's less than 60, so it's an assumption that there's no taste, then it's permitted. Not only is it permitted, but as the Nosei Kelim write on Shulchan Aruch, if you don't eat it, you are a heretic. Because you're denying the rules of Chazal, you think that a little bit of milk in your cholent is a problem. It's not a problem. If there's no taste, post facto, you have to forget about it, eat it. And we have all types of principles that go in this direction, such as Ti'imat Kfela. Right, that if you give it to a non-Jew to taste, and he tells you, yeah, it tastes like meat, no hint of milk, so then it is kosher. Again, how exactly we work out all the details of tasting plus a 60th is subject to machlokas, Ashkenazim, and Sfaradim, and fine. But the basic principle is, taste is what's important. However we determine taste is a different question. So therefore he says, I am ready to throw out all the halachot, the post-facto questions. If you have a clean pot that was used an hour ago with milk, and now you accidentally use it with meat, the only question I care about now is there taste, yes or no? And the answer is no. The answer is no. And therefore, all those halachot disappear. However, koshering kelim, or using the same pots for milk and meat, he thinks you still have to kosher, and you can't use the same pots for milk and meat, and he gives three reasons. One is a rabbinic one. Right, one is, as we said at the beginning, on a biblical level, in order to violate meat and milk, what do you need to do? Cook the milk and meat together and eat it. Right, that's it. Right, and yet, right, and remember, we need to cook meat and milk. By meat, what do we mean? Meat, not poultry. And according to the Rambam, kosher shechted meat, not nevela. Right, so you need to cook cow that was shechted, right, with milk, and eat that, right? Short of that, you don't violate the biblical law. And yet, rabbinically, we forbid chicken, right? We forbid you to eat milk and meat together, even not cooked. We have minhagim of waiting between meals, whatever that means, right? The Gemara says between meals, we translate into whatever we translate into, an hour, 3 hours, 6 hours, whatever, right, using different loaves of bread and different knives and different, all that stuff is true. So he says, first of all, rabbinically, even if it were true that taste doesn't transfer, just like we prohibited eating milk and meat within 6 hours of each other, so we should prohibit using the vessels one after the other, just like we find all types of other decrees. The second point he raises is what's called Ein Mevatlin Isser L'Chatchila, which is, is it really true that our pots don't absorb anything? He says, I don't know. Right? They don't absorb enough to impart taste, but let's say 1/1,000,000th of a particle goes into the walls. So post facto, that's irrelevant, right? If I cook in a pot and 1/1,000,000th of a particle is in the walls and it goes right from the chicken soup into my cream of mushroom soup, it is irrelevant halachically. But ab initio, meaning if I have the choice, I shouldn't do it. Right, it's called Ein Mevatlin Isser L'Chatchila, right? The way it normally comes out is if milk spills into my cholent, if it's less than 1/60th, I can eat it. But I can't take less than 1/60th of the milk and pour it into the meat. That would be usser, right? That's forbidden. That's called Ein Mevatlin Isser L'Chatchila. So he says point two is, if there's even 1/1,000,000th of a particle left over from the chicken soup in the walls of the pot, so post facto, you don't have to worry about it. But if you choose to cook your cream of mushroom soup in the chicken soup pot without koshering it, you are, quote unquote, nullifying that 1/1,000,000 that's sitting in the walls. And principle three is he challenges the entire assumption that hechsher kelim, that koshering, is really based on taste at all. And the argument basically goes as follows. The Rambam and the Ramban and others think that tam, ki'ikar, the notion that taste is important in halacha, is itself only rabbinic, which creates a problem. Because if taste is only rabbinic, meaning biblically it's only prohibited to have a cheeseburger if you cook it together, but if you had the taste of milk and the taste of meat cooked together, it would only be forbidden rabbinically. Or if you had the taste of pig, it would only be forbidden rabbinically. So then, why did the Torah ever say you need to kosher kelim? Right, the Gemara had said the reason you have to kosher kelim is because you might use it within the first 24 hours. But if you think even within the first 24 hours the taste that exists is only rabbinic, so then why did the Torah say you have to kosher kelim to begin with if taste is irrelevant? So many have suggested, among them Rabbi Soloveitchik and others, he quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik in the actual article, that maybe we misunderstood Hechsher Kalim entirely. We assume that the only reason we kosher Kalim is to remove problems, and Tvila is what adds holiness. But how do you know? Maybe Hechsher Kalim is also a type of Tvila, a type of adding holiness. And therefore, even when there's no problem of taste, the fact that it was used for non-kosher food or for meat and milk makes it a non-kosher pot and needs two processes to make it holy, right? One is tevila, if it came from a non-Jew, and two is hechsher, in order to imbue it with the status of holy pot, right? Or non-impure pot. So based on those three principles, the compromise position that he carves out is any post facto question, right? Whenever you call up, right, whoever you call up with your kosher shaddas and say, I accidentally cooked my cream of mushroom soup in my chicken soup pot. Anytime that happens, the answer will always be, if it's clean, it's permitted. That's it, end of story. No asking, was it 24 hours? No asking anything, right? But if someone calls you up and says, okay, I've already cooked my cream of mushroom soup in my chicken soup pot, do I have to kosher it to now use it for chicken soup? The answer will be yes, right? So that's the compromise that he comes up with. Now, at first glance, that doesn't sound like such a big game changer in halacha, right? Because once you create the compromise position, right, so sometimes it'll come up, right? Sometimes you do cook in the wrong pot, but how often do you do it? Except there's one halachic question, which is definitionally a bidyeved question, right? A post facto question that drives everybody crazy in their kitchens, that he doesn't address here, but inevitably emerges from what he said. And that is what I mentioned before, davar charif. All the laws of sharp foods, right? Anyone who's ever asked a kosher shaila knows the answer is usually is permitted, unless you had an onion. Right? If you had an onion, everything goes crazy. Except onion, why does an onion make problems? Because we assume that when you take a knife that was dairy and you cut an onion with it, even if it was cold, it takes the hidden dairy taste and transfers it into the onion. But that is always a post facto question. Right? Is there or is there not taste? And if the answer is there is no dairy taste in your stainless steel knife, then all of davar charif disappears. Right? Onions, garlic, none of that is important anymore. Right? None of that is relevant because there is no taste. So one of my friends emailed Rav Malamud this question and he said, wait for the final version. Right? But yes, seemingly his conclusion from what I gather is that. Right? He didn't discuss it here, but there is in fact a big, right, this is in fact a big deal, right, because it means that all those problems, onions, garlic, whatever, lemons, etc., disappear, right? All those problems evaporate into thin air because there is no taste. Okay, so what we've seen so far, therefore, is the local issue of how does kashrus deal with, now again, whether this will be accepted, I don't know. I have my doubts that it will be accepted by the broader halachic community, but he's at least a significant enough posek that people will have to deal with it. So how it all shakes out, I don't know. Rav Schechter has had a middle position for years, which is this will be what happens when Mashiach comes, but it can't happen yet because it's a davar shebeminyan. It's a formal halacha that needs to be voted on. So the local question we've seen, but we've also seen the broader question, which is how does halacha deal with scientific change, where he himself notes that you could take three possibilities, right? Reject science, reject the previous halacha, or come up with some compromise, right? Where certain parts of it are predicated on science and certain cases are reinterpreted to have formal status that is not tied to the scientific question. That model can be used pretty much everywhere, and the answer won't always be equivalent, right? Because some halachot are more based on reality and some are less. Okay. The last question, a few final points. The last question he deals with, which I think is particularly important here, is, okay, when we said before the lice case, whose scientific knowledge are we quote-unquote impugning when we say that lice do in fact procreate? The rabbis, right? The rabbis. whose scientific knowledge would you be impugning, right, here, potentially? God, right? Because God is the one who said you have to kosher kalim. And if you think that there is no formal level to koshering, it's only about taste, then that means God, quote-unquote, made a mistake. That can't be, right? So how do you deal with that problem? So either you assume that that's the proof that koshering has nothing to do with taste, it has to do with some formal, spiritual, you know, metaphysical state, or you come up with some compromise position, which is what he does, which is to argue that maybe it never really meant taste. It meant, right, it meant the thin film of food that's stuck on the sides. And when they talk about absorbed food, they don't really mean absorbed into the walls itself, because metal has never changed, right? Our stainless steel may be better quality, but metal itself never absorbed. Right? It must be that it was the film on the outside. Now, a simpler answer I would have said is no, the reality has changed, right? Yes, metal, like steel itself or iron itself, taste does not actually go into the molecules from your chicken soup into the metal. But that's not the question here. The question is, was it absorbed into the kli, into the vessel? The answer is, in our high-quality stainless steel pots, no. 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago, in metal pots that were made however they made it, the answer was likely yes, right? Not because it went into the metal, but because like it was porous. Like, if you can't make really good pots, there are in fact little crevices that things are going to go in. So I would have just said it's not a problem at all. It's not that, right, he has a problem because he says metal is metal is metal. The answer is metal may be metal, but modern stainless steel pots are not the ancient iron rusty pots of 1500 years before the Common Era. So I would have just said it's not a problem. You're not impugning God's science, right? It's just a reality that their pots weren't as compressed and high quality as ours, so taste actually got in somewhere into the wall. So the reality has in fact changed. Not like, right, that's not such a chachma to say that, yes, our pots are better qualities than they were 3,000 years ago. So then I'm not sure why he bothers it. Why it bothered him so much. Now, what is clear here is that all of this is only true if your pots are clean. If they're not clean, then all of this is irrelevant, which, from a practical perspective, from experience, right, makes this usually a good idea to have different dishes for meat and milk. As I mentioned to Ura, right, the only place on earth that I'm confident that the pots are fully clean is at my in-laws, right? Otherwise, somehow my mother-in-law makes it fully clean, but I can't do it, right? At my parents' house, it was not that clean, right? Somehow there's always something stuck on the sides, in which case you should always have separate dishes for milk and meat on a practical perspective. Okay. The last thing I want to note, I'll summarize and then I'll make the last point as a ha'ara at the end. Right, so to summarize, we've seen the local question, which is our halacha of kashrus actually based on taste or not? Right, and two, if it is, what do we do when science has changed? So as for the broader question, we noted that either you can update the halacha in light of new evidence, you can reinterpret the evidence to assume that halacha wasn't based on the reality at all, or you can come up with a compromise position and say there is a level of formality that doesn't change when you update information, and certain things do. So in this particular case, that's the direction he takes, and he assumes that post facto questions, like I accidentally cooked my milk soup in my meat pot, will always be permitted. Ab initio questions, do I have to kosher? The answer will be yes, because there is a spiritual level to it. How are our dishes different than the ones 3,000 years ago? Is it because really absorbed taste is the film on the outside, and as he says, they didn't have the soaps we have, they didn't have the sponges we have, and we get rid of that, and therefore reality has changed? Or do you say that simply, as I would suggest, the quality of our pots? His compromise, therefore, again, is that post facto questions, we do change the halacha, but ab initio questions, we do not change the halacha. As he notes, people can argue in either direction, either by saying we don't change tradition because we don't change tradition, or we do change the halacha entirely and even get rid of koshering. In theory, that's a potential position as well, though he takes the middle position. The last point I'll make here is one of presentation rather than substance. And people have heard me before know that I'm fond of this point, which is if you're trying to understand a posik, you're trying to understand anybody in life, it's important not just to look at what they write, but how they write. The fact that this was put online, in his discussions he says that he came to this conclusion, or if you got to this, by discussing it in the yeshiva and in the yeshuv, right, and in his community, and asking both rabbis and scientists, and the fact that I think I left this line in, I hope I did. Yes, it's the right by the end, right? That this is a Torah, this scientific view is novel. So I mistranslated this. I ask anyone with the proper education for this to critique or agree to this logic, or that he put it online and he gave a link and said, anyone who has any comments, email it to me. Shows something interesting, and this is a point that that Itamar Rahavtig makes Aviad HaKohen rather makes an article about. I mentioned last year in the thing, the winter program, about religious Zionist psak. Right, is the fact that he puts it online and asks for feedback from the average person, not just poskim, not just rabbis and people who know halacha, but anybody who has anything to add from any perspective, shows, right, having nothing to do with kashrus, that his perspective of who is supposed to be part of the conversation of halacha is not just rabbis or not just scholars, it's everybody has a voice. Right, when you decide to put it online and you decide to put a link for people to send you questions and you actually ask people for advice and incorporate it into your tshuva, more than just saying something with halachas kashrus, right, that means that you think as an ideological perspective that halacha should be a conversation between everybody in the community. Right? And if for nothing else, that's, I think, a fascinating thing to note about Rav Malamud, right, is that he asks in an active way for participation, actually updates his views based on the perspective of non-rabbinic experts, right? Which, while might be intuitive, right? Because rabbis should admit that they don't know everything, is actually not, right? Not always the norm. Not amongst rabbis, not amongst doctors, not amongst lawyers, right? People who are experts in their field tend to not like advice from non-experts, right? The fact that he does is actually something to think about, right? And be somewhat impressed with that. As an ideological statement, he thinks that everyone should and can be involved in halachic conversation. Which leads me just to the last point, which is, if anyone does have any comments, right? I mean, you can ask me, but right, it's actually a nice opportunity where he did leave a link on the website to email them. And if you actually have a comment either on halachic issues or on the scientific issues, right, and you want to email him, you can, which, you know, I think is a nice opportunity. I don't know if anyone does, but if you come up with anything, right, being able to be involved in emerging halacha, which may or may not be accepted by the halachic community, but who knows, being able to be part of the conversation itself is, I think, something important and a great opportunity. So if you want to avail yourself of it, the link is there. Thank you. And